Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah takes place May 15th to the 17th, 2020, at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.
Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by Enfilade. Enfilade is a flagship historical wargaming convention for the Northwest Historical Miniature Gaming Society. Enfilade is held annually over Memorial Day weekend at the Red Lion Inn in Olympia, Washington. Enjoy the largest historical miniature gaming convention west of the Mississippi at Enfilade. Visit www.nhmgscitadel.com for more information. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by The Wargaming Company. Wish you could play a great Napoleonics wargame that's different from the same old stuff? Try ESR. ESR makes Napoleonics accessible, a complete system with you as the core commander. Start an army with ESR box sets or use your existing collection. It's meaty enough for diehards, but friendly for newcomers. Visit thewargamingcompany.com. Welcome to Wargaming Recon. I'm Jonathan J. Reinhardt. Wargaming Recon is the only member of the TSR Podcast Network to discuss historical and New England gaming. Today, we have a very special guest, and I would say it's a very special episode, but then all of you would make fun of me because I've said that a lot lately. But they've all been really special episodes, and they've all been really special guests. So I'm sorry, but we're just working extra hard to get really great people for all of you. We're joined by the one and only Mr. Henry Hyde, who's going to talk about all the incredible things that he's been doing. But in case you're not familiar, Henry is the author of the best-selling Wargames book, The Wargaming Compendium. He's owner of Gladius Publications, host of Battle Chat, which is an amazing podcast. I've been on there. And he does all sorts of other really cool tip-top gaming stuff and just like everything. He's a true Renaissance man. So I want to introduce the one and only Mr. Henry Hyde. Henry, how are you today?
Hi, Jonathan. I'm absolutely fine and a Renaissance man. So do I need to sound like I'm quoting Shakespeare the whole time?
Oh, see, that's a wonderful thing about being British. You always sound like that.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, etc. There we go.
There you go. See, now, if I tried that, or anyone here in America, it would come out as rubbish. And so there's just a reason why people like to listen to you and everyone over from England so much more than the rest of us.
Oh, bless your heart. No, it's fine. And there's some American and Canadian accents that I really love, actually. There's a lot of, wow, I mean, gosh, Morgan Freeman, what can I say?
Oh, man, I want him to narrate my funeral.
But not just yet.
Well, one hopes not.
Coronavirus or no, not just yet. Please, please, please. Anyway, thanks for the introduction, Jonathan. How have you been, my friend?
I've been okay. I mean, life is weird, right? You guys are in lockdown over there.
Yeah.
Here, so it's weird. In the United States, every state is doing its own kind of thing with lockdown. Some are official, some are not, some aren't doing anything, which I think is bizarre and stupid. But I try not to pass judgment, at least not aloud.
Well, you just did, buddy.
but here in Massachusetts, where I normally don't mention politics, but it's important to this just for the framing of it. So we're a very liberal state where there's a lot of people who are very liberal minded, and for most of the state, but there are segments of the state that have strong conservative populations. And for whatever reason, we have a history of choosing our legislature, our state legislature, to be very liberal and our executive branch to be very conservative. And so our governor, our executive branch, is a Republican, is a conservative, and he has felt that he has not wanted to officially put us into a lockdown because he doesn't feel that it might, he thinks it might not be completely legal to restrict people to their homes for such a period of time. And he's worried about personal freedoms and things like that. So we have I think the wording is that you are strongly advised to stay home.
Tell me about it. Strongly advised.
Yeah. Basically, it's a lockdown, but like if you violate it, they can't fine you or throw you in jail or anything like that.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because here in the UK as well, they've been very cautious about actually imposing any kind of diktat. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like you. It sounds exactly the same. It's like it, technically it's advisory, but if you don't do it, you can get fined. So yes, they're way wobbling somewhere in between. I think it would be much easier if, like in Italy or France or wherever, they just said this is the law for the time being. You know, it's a much more honest kind of approach. But anyway, the fact is, here in the UK, we've had just about coming up to 3 weeks of lockdown, and they've made it clear it's going to be another 3 weeks to go. And the 3 week thing is because there's actually something written into our law, into our, you know, we don't have much of a constitution here. It's all done by precedent. But there is this thing where the government is not allowed to impose anything for a period of longer than 3 weeks at a time.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's really strange. So they have to get cabinet approval again every 3 weeks, even though the doctors and everyone talk in terms of months, because of this strange thing we've got over here, it has to be renewed every 3 weeks. Go figure. I have no clue, Jonathan, why that should be the case.
That's really weird. I know here in Massachusetts, they're talking about like things returning to normal, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Like beginning of May, like May 4th, May 7th ish.
Yeah, and not going to happen, is it?
I don't believe them. I really don't. And I know some of the public school systems around here have decided they're just done for the rest of the school year. It's going to be all remote learning. But not all of them have made that designation. Mm. And I work for municipal government. And they've decided that so far they're going to follow whatever the schools do. So like I work from home right now. Mm. But that's only until the beginning of May. And they really want to open as quickly as they can. So I don't honestly know with us what we're going to do. But I think it's silly to think that that's going to happen. Because, I mean, we're like 2 weeks behind everyone else. And we're just getting into the hit of it all.
And I just did a podcast with Annie Norman of Bad Squiddo Games the other day. You might have had a chance to listen to it. Where we were saying, because like my other half, Annie, not Annie Norman of Bad Squiddo Games, but my other half, Annie Prescott, has Crohn's disease and so is on immunosuppressant drugs. And the immunosuppressant people said to her, she must be in isolation for at least 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that was only 3 weeks ago. So that's giving you a more realistic indication, I think, that this thing is likely to go on probably for, you know, a couple of months more at the very least. And you could say realistically, until there's a vaccine, everyone, you know, I can't see everyone's behavior returning to, in inverted commas, normal or whatever normal is now. I think that's one of the other interesting things, isn't it? There's now discussions emerging about, what is normal now?
Yeah.
I mean, the British were aloof enough as it is, you know, into keeping social distance almost as a matter of course because of our national characteristics, you know. Well, now, you know, the 2 meters thing as well. I'm considering carrying a halberd, right?
There you go.
A medieval weapon like a glaive, which is 2 meters long, because that will make it absolutely clear if someone's getting too close because they'll feel the pointy end.
I've heard of some people wearing like those weird hats that go on and then putting pool noodles on them that are, you know, long enough so that if they feel a jostle, then someone knows like they got a little too close.
Oh, dear.
So it's weird. One of the great things in, I think it's important to look for positives with all the craziness that's going on. One of the great things is that with all this extra time not being at work, there's time, hopefully, if people still have income coming in, there's time to enjoy things that maybe you couldn't enjoy so much as leisurely pursuits, things like reading books or listening to podcasts. And the odd thing is, because people tend to listen to podcasts when they commute or at the gym or whatever, podcast listenership is decreasing. And have you found any impact with any of this? Because, I mean, these are areas that you're very much involved with. You've written books, you're writing books right now. You're a publisher as well. You narrate audiobooks and you have your own podcast. So have you seen any impact? And do you want to talk about any of these kind of things?
More than happy to talk about it, Jonathan. So far, I've not noticed any decline of listenership to my stuff. But then because I'm so very focused on hobby stuff, and now there are a lot more people out there who are, as you say, finding time to paint their armies that have sat languishing unpainted on shelves for ages, in my experience they're looking for extra stuff to listen to while they're doing the painting. The irony is, for me, actually, I've been working 7 days a week flat out because my other half, Annie, can't work. I've suddenly got and the government, so far what our government has offered us, shall we say, subsidy or help to micro businesses like mine, amounts to, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh yeah, sweet Fanny Adams, we'd say politely over here in the UK. Absolutely zilch, zero, nichts, nada, rien, right?
That's awful.
It's not like I can stop work. And fortunately, I've been able to keep working. My order books at the moment are full of stuff, partly, you know, obviously my Patreon gig keeps me busy anyway, doing podcasts, blog posts, little videos, you know, that kind of thing. But the majority of my income still comes from my graphic design work. And now I've just edited my first novel for someone else, which was like, wow. But it's like, I might as well talk about it for a bit. It was an interesting opportunity because this young woman, it was her first novel, she's self-publishing. She actually got offered a deal by Simon & Schuster, and she turned it down because they wanted her to change too much about the novel, which is, it's an interesting, I'll tell you what it's about. She's going to be releasing it early next month, I think. It's called The Boy Who Saw in Colors, and it's actually a fascinating story about a young lad in wartime Germany who's taken away from his parents and brought up in an elite Hitler youth school, right? As often was the case, that the Nazis decided, right, well, your parents, we don't think that they're pure Aryan enough, so we're going to take you away from them and school you and instruct you in the pure Nazi way in this kind of boarding school. Fascinating story. The lad has, he doesn't suffer from, but he has the condition known as synesthesia. So he tastes colors. You know, he hears, tastes, and all the rest of it. It's all his senses are mixed up, and he's got artistic leanings. And it's a fantastic story, this young, sensitive boy being brought up in this utterly brutal environment. And the other part, important part of the story, is that his father was actually Jewish. His mother was Aryan, but his father was Jewish. So he's got this secret that he's keeping as he's going through the war with these other boys. It's actually a fascinating story. But anyway, this young woman who wrote it is actually in Ireland, Northern Ireland. Lauren Robinson is her name. And she had sent me the manuscript to do the layout, the graphic design layout for. And being someone who's, you know, I've been an editor for a long time myself, I started going through this manuscript to lay it out, and I thought, oh my God, has this been edited at all? So I had a long conversation with her and said, Lauren, this manuscript you sent to me, have you accidentally sent me your first draft? And she said, no, that's come straight from this guy who I paid $500 to edit the manuscript. I said, well, I don't know how to break this to you, but I've got to tell you, I can't see any evidence that he's done any work editing or proofreading this at all. So anyway, she was heartbroken, obviously, and distraught. So in the end, I've ended up offering to edit it as it should have been edited for the same money as she paid this guy, whilst also helping her to get her money back from this other bloke who's a complete charlatan. So that's how I've ended up editing, because I've edited lots of non-fiction stuff before, you know, magazines and military history books, that kind of stuff. But this is the first time I've actually edited a novel, which was quite nerve-wracking, because obviously it's a very different kind of gig. But it's such fascinating subject matter, and as I was going through it, I developed a real rapport with this young writer because, of course, I studied German history at university. So I was able to say, you've got this scene here where this guy comes into the room and gives him some marker pens and they start writing on the floor. And I said, no, that couldn't happen. Marker pens didn't arrive until the 50s, right? And this is set in 1940. There was another instance where she had these boys sitting in the garden of the school somewhere eating chocolate bars. And I said, yeah, that's not going to happen. Germany have been on rations since the 30s because of, you know, the massive inflation and depression they'd had. Mm-hmm. So the only chocolate that existed in Germany in any quantity at the time was this stuff. It's fascinating for people like us, this stuff called Flieger Schokolade, which was a high cocoa content chocolate and other stuff mix that was purely sent to the front line in rations for guys on the front line. But obviously in this Nazi school, there was a possibility that the headmaster, who's a bit kind of black markety corrupt, maybe had got hold of some of this stuff. So the boys could potentially be eating some of that, for example, and various other things where, you know, she just used language that was so 21st century. And I said, you know, they wouldn't have said that in 1942 Germany or whatever. So it's been a really, really fascinating process and another string to my bow, you could say, because as you mentioned, I Renaissance man is a nice description. Some people would be cruel and say jack of all trades, master of none. I just like to think that I develop my creative expertise in many directions. That's how I put it.
Well, I think you obviously are very talented for anyone who's ever encountered any of your work. And this novel that this woman's creating that you are editing, it really does sound intriguing to me. And I hope it does very well.
Yeah, it really is. And the thing is, it's quite interesting where, you know, previously I've done kind of magazine editing and a military history book editing, that kind of thing. And it's a nice job. People need to understand that editing is not terribly well paid. You know, it's a nice enough job, but for nonfiction stuff, it's not a terribly intimate relationship. Whereas with this, you know, when you're editing someone's fiction, which is their baby, their first novel, you know, you have to be quite diplomatic. You know, you have to develop your diplomatic skills because someone's put their heart and soul into this. And it's actually very brave of someone to submit their work, brave and professional, you know, because this is the thing. Once you've finished writing your book, you have to understand that much as you love the story and the characters and all that kind of thing, it's become a product. And the job of the editor and the designer and stuff is to make that the best possible product. So my job is to make the author look good, both visually in terms of design and stuff, because, you know, I do the book jacket and the interior. But also now I've got that editing role as well. It's, you know, you don't want this person's experience to be their book being launched and that first day on Amazon when they go and check the reviews and there's a load of one-star reviews with people slagging it off saying, oh my God, there's so many typos in it. Oh my God, there's so many factual errors. Oh my God. And there's bits of German in there as well. So she's extremely lucky that she's stumbled upon someone who speaks fluent German as well, right? So again, what this other editor thought they were doing, it was just shocking. So anyway, there's that. And the graphic design, I've got lots of other graphic design on at the moment. I think I can reveal that I am designing a new World War II rule set for, well, it's the same people. It's Two Fat Lardies, so Rich Clark and Nick Skinner of Two Fat Lardies, but they have this other publishing arm called Reisfitz Press, which so far they've used I think it's all been stuff for Dave Brown, who's a well-known wargamer over here, who I've interviewed on my show. And yeah, they've previously published for him an American Civil War rule set and a Napoleonic rule set. And I'm now doing the design and layout for a World War II rule set called O Group, which is kind of a... Well, it's whatever level you like, really, but I'd probably say it's company to battalion level kind of stuff.
Okay.
And Dave Brown actually has served in the Territorial Army, so he, you know, he knows his stuff. And it's a very, very comprehensive rule set. Dave doesn't do little quick fast play rules. He does, yeah, this is as much grit and depth as you want. And it's quite a challenge. It's quite a big rule set from, you know. So I've just started doing that, amongst other things, other book design work. I've been doing science fiction. This has been nice. I've actually got to design a book jacket for a lovely lady, Suze Parnham Harris, her name is, who's the first science fiction client I've had, doing real classic kind of space stations hovering above planet type sci-fi covers. You know, the kind of thing you would have seen a lot of back in the 60s and 70s. Really nice kind of throwback stuff. So, yeah, it's cool. But, yeah, I'm just busy, 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 Jonathan. That kind of sums up how I've been.
That's, I mean, it's good that you're able to do this and to keep income coming. But it must be hard on you, though, too, because you don't get a break, do you? I mean, you're working 7 days a week. You have all this other stuff going on and just the worries of everything, really. It must be a lot for you.
It's quite a lot of pressure. I mean, on top of the fact that I have a slight case of cancer, you know.
I didn't want to bring it up unless you wanted to talk about it.
Well, you know, I don't mind. I've been very open about it. My whole point, you know, I've been doing my prostate cancer video diary series, which is about time I did another one, actually, to bring people up to date. Yeah, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer last, when was it, October, something like that? Lost track of time, September or October. And they put me pretty much straight onto hormone therapy, which is interesting. I have 3 monthly big injections that kind of last the 3 months. And essentially what happens, if you're a guy listening, don't squirm too much. It's a fact of life. If you're a guy of a certain age, you know, and I will say this, you know, if you're a guy of, you know, a white guy, 50, 55 plus, or a black guy, 45 plus, go get yourself checked, because the earlier it's caught, the higher your survival chances. And I was very lucky that my very diligent type 2 diabetes nurse actually just at the end of the questionnaire, she gives me every 6 months when they take my bloods and say, oh, you know, have you noticed anything else that happened? You know, you've noticed that's different from last time I saw you. I said, well, I'm probably imagining it. I said, but I think it's taking me a bit longer to have a wee. And she said, oh, I'll just take a bit more blood. And thanks to that, she discovered that my what's called prostate-specific antigen level in my blood, which is just these things running around in your blood if you've got prostate cancer, was above normal. And that triggered the whole, okay, we're going to send you for a, don't laugh, it's called a digital examination, but we're talking about your fingers as digits, right? Yep. So this is the finger up the bottom test, guys. What a laugh. But that confirmed there was something wrong. And then they sent me off for a biopsy, which was a really weird experience. But that definitely confirmed that I actually had very high grade prostate cancer, that even though my bloods were kind of borderline, the cancer itself was very aggressive. So that's why they put me straight onto this hormone therapy. And what the hormone therapy does is it just completely suppresses all your testosterone, because prostate cancer feeds on testosterone. So effectively, I've become a menopausal middle-aged woman.
Oh, well, that's a transformation for you.
Well, it is. But that's the best way to describe it, because it means that you get hot flushes and you get sudden emotional episodes. And that has also morphed more recently. You know, I'm very open talking about mental health like you are, Jonathan. Mm-hmm. It's morphed more recently into me experiencing anxiety attacks for the first time in my life, which is was unexpected. Let's put it that way. It was unexpected. So just, you know, just in case I didn't have enough to cope with.
They're scary.
Let's bang in a bit more. So yeah, that's it's been interesting, but I decided, you know, just me because of who I am, I decided that part of my own coping mechanism would just be to be completely open about it and talk about it, because the trouble is too many guys don't talk about it, mm-hmm. and to be blunt, end up dead because they didn't want to tell anyone about what they were suffering from.
Yeah.
And the fact is, guys, this is one of those subjects that, it's, you know, makes you feel a bit queasy and awkward and uncomfortable. And obviously it's a part of your body that's as vulnerable as it gets. But the fact is, you know, if you notice any kind of symptoms and, you know, taking longer to have a wee is just one of the most obvious ones. Some people suffer from erectile dysfunction. Some people get odd pains and stuff. The bottom line is just go get yourself checked, because the check itself, that initial checkup is a blood test, 30 seconds with someone sticking a needle in your arm. They send it off. And most people, it comes back that, no, it's not prostate cancer. It's something else that, you know, because you can get an enlarged prostate as you get older. It can be other forms of what's called prostatitis. But if it is the cancer, at least it means like they know and they can do something about it. And there is a saying someone told me, more people die with prostate cancer than of prostate cancer, because it's mainly associated with elderly men. And sometimes the prostate cancer may have been growing inside them for years without them ever knowing it. And then it's growing so slowly that the doctors might say, well, actually, we'll just wait and see. And, you know, they'll end up dying of a heart attack or, God forbid, COVID-19 before the prostate cancer gets them. But if you know about it, then you can deal with it and the doctors can address the issue. And frankly, that little nurse saved my life, because it turned out the cancer inside mine had already got outside the prostate gland into one of the lymph nodes. And that's where it gets really dangerous, because if it gets into your lymph nodes and spreads around your body, that's not nice. So anyway, there you go, Jonathan. I'm more than happy to talk very openly about these kind of things, because I think that people need to. It's the kind of thing that too often gets swept under the carpet. And people need to hear that, you know, there are folks like me living with it, coping fine with it. You know, I get these weird emotional episodes sometimes, and sometimes I feel utterly exhausted. In fact, I'll be honest, I have been normally working like 7 days a week, pretty much flat out. I took 2 days off over this Easter weekend. Now, wow. For me, I can't remember the last time I took 2 days off in a row. But I needed to, because I realized I had just worked myself absolutely into the ground and was going to be no good to anyone if I was just, you know, falling asleep at the wheel, as it were. So, yeah, there we are. And I did some stuff like just sitting and listening to music and sitting out on the balcony and looking at the sunset and, you know, ordinary stuff. And I admit, at least for the first 24 hours, I was really twitchy, feeling like, shouldn't I be working? Shouldn't I be doing something? I've got loads to do. Oh my God, my to-do list is enormous. What am I doing sitting? How can I allow myself to just relax? That's shocking, outrageous. And fortunately, my other half, Annie, she's very placid and calm. She's like, yeah, Henry, get back to that on Tuesday. You'll be fine. I was like, oh yeah, okay. So there we are. That's me in lockdown.
Well, do you know what? I think you raised some really great points there. And I have to say, like, on a personal note, that when you first started talking about your journey with cancer, it made me more aware of just like my own body and health. Mm. And it's a little thing, but the thing that worked for you was I'm more aware of my output, and I know I'm not in that age range for it or anything, but I'm just like, I'm more aware about like, oh wait, this is something I should pay attention to, because not now, but you know, in the coming years and so forth, it'll be more important to really have a focus on that. And I think it's really important for people that you can do it so easily and non-invasively. So I think more people will have a tendency to try to evaluate that. It's like for people, for a breast exam that you can just do yourself in the shower. Yeah. And you just go, like, if it was something more involved than just feeling around for a lump, people might not do it. And I mean, people may not do it to begin with, but it's relatively accessible for people to do. So like things like that, I think just it's easier. And if you have that lower bar to entry to anything, chances are people will pick it up. And yeah. I think not only is it, you mentioned it's a coping mechanism for you, but I think it's also very brave of you to be willing to stand out there and to use yourself as an example of what you're experiencing that others may also experience. Mm-hmm. And that people can kind of look. And I think people do look and say like, oh, you know, Henry's going through this, and if Henry can do it, then maybe I can too. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's your intention or that you want such a thing, but I think it's nice that that option exists for those who so choose.
Yeah, well, it was certainly my intention to encourage people, seriously, because when I saw the statistics about how many people are caught too late, the numbers of deaths from prostate cancer are actually pretty scary. Mm-hmm. And you know, talking with my oncologist and the staff at the hospital and stuff, and they're saying, yeah, you know, it really is. If only more men were more open about things and got the message out that it's okay to admit that you're not okay, right? Yeah. And particularly because it's that part of the body that, you know, no one wants to start admitting that, yeah, do you know what? God, you know, I when I used to go for a pee, it took me half the time it's taking now. What's going on there? I think there's something wrong, but oh, la, 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 I don't want to think about it. Fingers in my ears, la, 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 you know. Guys, just take your fingers out your ears and go get yourself checked. It's such a tiny thing, you know. No one would even notice you've gone away for the check. Mm-hmm. And I'm delighted as well that, you know, other people we know in the podcasting world have taken up that baton and gone and got themselves checked. And so far, touch wood, they've all come back and said, yeah, well, okay, I did have some concerns, but actually going and get myself checked has solved those concerns. I feel much better about doing it, which is fantastic. But also from my point of view, I thought I'd be honest because obviously, like you, Jonathan, you know, I'm not famous in the real sense. You know, I'm not kind of I'm not a rock star or anything like that. You know, I'm well known in our little niche, the wargaming world, you know, but, you know, and in fact, well known in the historical niche of the wargaming world, which is tiny compared to fantasy and sci-fi and all the rest of it. You know, the other day, as you probably saw, I interviewed Alessio Cavatore from Games Workshop, who's a mega star, you know, from Games Workshop, did the Lord of the Rings rules and all the rest of it. You know, oh my God, it's Alessio Cavatore, right? Compared to him, I'm just some guy, you know. But I realized since I wrote the book, actually, that even though I'm, you know, a tiny Z minus list celeb, right, people have expectations of me. So it actually, I find it's helpful to let people know what condition I'm in to help manage their expectations of what I'm able to do in a certain amount of time, right?
Yeah.
That, you know, whether it comes to, Henry, when are you going to finish that darn book? Right? So at least by being honest about what's going on, they can understand, yeah, he's got quite a lot on his plate at the moment, so maybe I shouldn't keep pushing the book button all the time, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually quite useful for me to help manage people's expectations, because I don't want to let people down, Jonathan, you know? No. I'm one of those guys, I was brought up, if a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing well. And I don't want to put out any product that's subpar, you know, below what I feel it ought to be in terms of quality. That's just who I am. Mm-hmm. So I'd hate to feel like I got kind of overwhelmed by people pressuring me to like finish the book or do this other thing and end up just cranking something out that I afterwards thought, oh, that could have been better. You know, I'd much rather let people know what the situation is and have them understand that you're going to have to wait a while, guys. But when it does arrive, I promise you, it will be, you know, it's going to blow your socks off, that kind of thing.
I don't know if you're this way as well, but for me, like the pressure you're talking about, more often than not, it's internal. So like someone might ask about something, or they may not even say anything, but I'm thinking, oh, wait, it's been a while since I've done whatever. Mm-hmm. And people, they're just being kind. That's what I tend to tell myself. They're being kind. They're not insulting me. They're not saying anything to me because they're being kind. They're being generous. But really, inside, there's this turmoil, and they want whatever, and they think things should be better or quicker or whatever. Yeah. And so then I end up putting a lot of that on myself. And Yeah. I'm not sure how common that is among creators or not, or if it's something that
massively common. Massively common. Of course it is, Jonathan. I mean, for example, one of the things I do every couple of months or so, I do a Q&A session for my patrons who are sergeant level and above. So they can send in questions to me, and then I sit there and do a solo show giving all the answers. Well, my patrons have cottoned onto this, and oh my God, the lists of questions I get for my Q&A is like astonishing. And the last, well, the one before this that I did, I think in total was like 6 hours. I broke it, had to break it into two sections, and the same's happened again. So I, a couple of weeks ago, I recorded part one of my Q&A, and that was like 3 hours, and I was exhausted. So I said, look guys, I'm going to stop here, pick it up again as soon as I can, and do part two. And sure enough, today someone just commented on my site. They said, oh, so Henry, when's part two coming out? And they probably meant it completely innocently, just out of curiosity. But immediately my head says, oh my god, how am I going to fit in recording part two of this Q&A, because I know it's going to be like another 3 to 4 hour show. Well, you do this gig, Jonathan. You know how much hard work that is.
I'm right? Feeling anxiety for you.
Yes. So immediately it's like, oh, no. Yes, I know. It's on the to-do list. But part of my dilemma is I've got all this other work with deadlines for clients out there who need me to finish designing their rules, their books, whatever. Yeah. And I've also got my patrons out. I mean, this is one of the wonderful things. I count myself incredibly lucky, Jonathan, that I've now got, about 260-something patrons who are paying me something like $1,400 a month to do stuff for them. You know, they're supporting my creative output.
That's
which
wonderful.
Is fantastic. It is. And I love them all to death. They're fabulous people. But at the same time, it's down to this kind of management of expectations things where, you know, I've been clear with them from the get-go that $1,400 a month is not nothing. That's great. Okay. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't cover, it doesn't pay me enough for me to just give up doing everything else to just be a Patreon creative. How I wish it would. That would, you know, if we start getting up to like $2,500-$3,000 a month, then I've got some serious choices to make about, well, actually, yeah, I could turn this into like my full-time gig, and then the other stuff is kind of what I do in my spare time, rather than the other way around. So yes, I've got this kind of little voice in my head that's saying, oh, you should be doing your Patreon. But if I'm doing the Patreon stuff, oh, you should be doing your graphic design. Right? There's like this Punch and Judy show going on my shoulders. Crazy. I know.
Well, and then you have crazy people from America saying, hey, you want to come on our show?
I couldn't possibly comment. No, it's lovely to be here, Jonathan. It's lovely to be. And this is probably going to be the shortest show conversation that we'll have had.
It will, because we tend to talk for long time.
Yeah.
And my episodes, even outside of you, and partly because of you, from inspiration from having had you on the show so many times, lately they've been skewing long. Today, and with, so it's weird because with the pandemic, although there's freedom, at least for me, to do more of these kind of things and still get all my work done and my hours in and everything, there's more like meetings and stuff than I've ever had before. And I love meetings. Like if my job was literally just meetings, I'd be happy as a pig in poo.
Oh, really? Are you a meetings
guy? I love a good
meeting.
I love a good meeting. I've been at meetings to talk about upcoming meetings.
I'm learning something about you today, Jonathan.
It's absurd, but you also got to keep in mind, I come from that whole like public service background with the bureaucracy and the whole political thing where like there's a meeting about everything. There's a meeting to talk about what you want to have at lunch at an upcoming meeting. And it's ridiculous, but it happens. And I like to network. So I feel like there's a lot of networking that happens
Fantastic.
There.
You're the complete opposite of me. I hate meetings. What I like is standing up meetings that last no longer than 5 minutes, right? So it's like, you've got a decision to make. We're going to make that decision here that we're not going to have a meeting about having a meeting about having a meeting about having a meeting. We're going to make the decision right here and now, which is why I'm self-employed, right?
Yes.
I have meetings with myself. Mind you, I have terrible arguments in some of those meetings, but...
Do you ever lose?
All the time. All the time. I'm outvoted. But no, seriously. So what have you been doing gaming-wise?
So I'm unlike you, because I know you've been playing some remote games of Command & Colors Ancients, right? Or Ancients or Napoleonics?
I played Red Alert with Jay Arnold, the veteran wargamer, you know, mm-hmm. Lovely guy with his own podcast. Well, we sort of played a game. We actually got it all wrong. By the time people started turning up to watch, we were still setting up the damn game.
Oh, no.
And then we only managed to get like two or three moves done. It was not conclusive. I think that's fair to say. And I think both of us went away with our tails between our legs, feeling a bit bashful about having subjected people to seeing us still setting up the blooming game. Because we chose a scenario that neither of us had played before.
Oh, okay.
And it turned out to be more complex, needing more cards and stuff and a lot more ships. And just have you got Red Alert yourself, Jonathan?
I don't, actually.
Well, it's a great game. It is. It's a Richard Ball Commands and Colors type game. You know, the same thing from Plastic Soldier, PSC Games, technically, isn't it? PSC Games. And there are lots of lovely little plastic spaceships, all of which have to be set up with bases that have got pegs that go into the underside of the craft.
Okay.
And I think it's fair to say that the fit isn't always magnificent on all of them. So
that's always the case.
Lots of muttering under the breath, you know, setting the things up. No, it's fallen off again. So anyway, it just was more time consuming to set up. And then we just ran out of time because I think Jay's missus was saying, it's time for dinner, guys. and it was like, oh, dear. So we'll try that again sometime. But no, the other thing I've done is played over Skype with my godson. Just small skirmish game, making up the rules as I went along kind of thing, based a bit on kind of the Legends of the High Seas, Warhammer historical type thing, with moves determined by, you know, the draw of cards out of a deck. So I was red cards, he was black cards, so it means that one side could get several actions in a row and stuff. I tell you what, it was fantastic. It was the last game we played was about 90 minutes. Setting it up on my table, trying to get a tripod on top of a couple of boxes, looking down at the right angle so you could see the table. That was fun in itself. And then it was just a frantic 90 minutes, and we laughed so much. It was just a silly little scenario where he had some guys he'd plundered a ship, and they'd taken it to their jungle hideout in the middle of this island, and then the Royal Navy and the Marines come to hunt down the pirate gang, you know, with Long John Silver kind of in charge, and they're in this little village in the middle of the island. They're loading up the wagon with their booty, and they've got to get the wagon off the edge of the table before my guys can come in and stop them. And it was just hilarious. It was just one of those things that ran very fast and was just lots of mad dice rolling and card drawing. It was just really funny. And that's where, because you probably know, you know, my godson has come back to wargaming after many years of absence. You know, I used to play war games with him till he was about, I don't know, 11 or 12, something like that. And then he discovered video games and went off and played video games for a long time. And then suddenly decided, oh, Henry, you know those games we used to play with the rat men and stuff? Oh, yeah, the Skaven. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, can we play something like that again? So I got him back into Advanced Hero Quest, and we've expanded that now into a bit of kind of Warhammer Fantasy Battle. I might try him out on Mantic Games' Kings of War for some of the big battles. But also now he's getting more interested in kind of historical stuff, all skirmish level. You know, I'm not going to suddenly throw him into the Battle of Borodino, you know, with Napoleonics and stuff. But he's realizing that stuff that's kind of historically based, you know, with pirates or cowboys or, you know, other skirmish level stuff, even World War II stuff, you know, it's fun. It's fun. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? To draw someone into the hobby, so long as they can see that, hey, this is fun, doesn't really matter what you're doing. And it doesn't, and, you know, one day he'll probably realize, hey, Henry, you were just making up those rules as we went along, weren't you? You know, I can't find them in any rule book. And it's like, yeah, you're right. But if it works, I think that's one of the great things that a more experienced gamer can do for a more novice gamer, which is just to, I mean, probably Richard Nick at Two Fat Lardies would call it free Kriegspieling.
Yes.
Right? Where you're basically just kind of making it up based on what's plausible at the moment. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to look at a situation and say, yeah, well, roll a 4, 5, or 6 and you've got me, right? Mm-hmm. Or, oh, yeah, but okay, it's going to be harder to hit him because he stood behind that palm tree, so that's going to need a 6 kind of thing. Move distances randomized where, you know, you walk one dice. So you move tactically or crawl one dice. You walk normally 2 dice. You run 3 dice, but there's a chance of you tripping up or falling over, something like that. This isn't, you know, rocket science. This is just making stuff off the cuff. And one of the great things, of course, about these sort of simple games is the more dice rolling there is, the more fun it is.
Yeah.
Right? Because also more dice rolling evens up the luck over the course of the game. But it makes, he hadn't got any real dice at his end when we were doing this game over Skype, but he downloaded an app onto his phone. I think it's called Natural 20, something like that, where you roll the dice on your phone and you can even get the clattery dice noise if you want, right? And it was fine. It was absolutely brilliant. So I'm hoping to be doing more of that kind of thing with him over the coming weeks, because let's face it, and there's loads of guys. Again, I had a wonderful guy called Brian Fish did a post on my Battle Games blog just the other day all about playing remote games, and he and his friends have been using a thing called Vassal, mm-hmm. where you can play lots of kind of what people would think of as normal kind of board war gamey type things over the internet using this system called Vassal, which looked, I'd never heard of it. So it's like, wow, it's got all the commands and colors modules on there and loads of other stuff. So I think I'm going to be trying out some of that as well, if I can.
That's fantastic.
So, there we go.
If people want to keep up to date with all the things you're doing, because I mean, you have so much stuff that's happening. It's hard to for people to just kind of remember it all. What are some of the best ways for them to stay up to date with everything that you have going on, Henry?
Okay, well, the very simplest place to start probably is people can go to the blog, which is battlegames.co.uk. That's battlegames.co.uk. The Patreon gig is at patreon.com/battlegames. That's easy to remember as well. patreon.com/battlegames. I'm on Twitter, as you know, Jonathan, @battlegames. Yakking away all the time. I have a Facebook page, Battle Games. if people start there, because we haven't had a chance really to talk about the Gladius publication stuff, that's another string to my bow. But if people look me up on Twitter @Gladius Books on Twitter, that's where I publicize what's happening. Because as you mentioned at the top of the show, yes, I'm now doing lots of PDF publications and all little audio booklets, not massive kind of 20-hour things, not yet anyway, that may happen, but at the moment stuff that's kind of like an hour and a half, 2 hours long, so again would go with a painting session, all budget priced. You know, the whole point of that little enterprise is to bring quality stuff in a digital format to wargamers and military history enthusiasts for not much money. There you go.
Awesome. Well, Henry, thank you so much for being on the show today, and we have to have you back again really soon.
Cool. Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I can't believe how much we've crammed into like 40 minutes or whatever it's been.
It's magic. Well, I want to thank everyone for taking the time to listen to this episode of Wargaming Recon. I want to remind you to check out all the links to the things that Henry had talked about, but in particular, be sure to check them out on Patreon. We can get battle chat and all sorts of really cool stuff, and those 6-hour Q&As. Don't hold Henry to them, though. Jeez, people. Give him a break. And just want to remind everyone, of course, that here we are everywhere on all the things as Wargaming Recon, social media, whatever. You can find us wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And we are, during the pandemic, are doing our pandemic coffee breaks Monday through Friday, 10:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. They last about half an hour. You'll find those on Facebook, and they end up on YouTube. And if you check those out, you'll hear me talking more about the brand new endeavor we have going on. We are co-sponsoring and co-organizing a virtual gaming convention called Let's Roll. So we are talking more about that in the pandemic coffee breaks. So Henry, thank you again. This has been a blast. And I know you're a busy, busy individual over there. It's just, it's wonderful.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a real pleasure.
So that was our interview with Henry Hyde, talking about Battle Chat and all the things he does over at Gladius Publications and his Patreon. And Henry's just wonderful to have on. But we also wanted to talk about a couple other things for you as well. And we didn't want to keep Henry, so I am doing this solo. I wanted to talk a little bit more about that Let's Roll convention. Now, I briefly mentioned it in somewhere in the podcast episode, but Wargaming Recon is officially co-sponsoring and co-organizing a virtual tabletop gaming convention. It's called Let's Roll. It'll take place May 16th, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are looking for GMs and we're looking for players. It is 100% free to play, to run games. There's no cost at all involved for any of you. If people want to, they can make a donation to us. We have a team that are fundraising for the Extra Life charity, which we've talked about before on the show, so I won't bore you with the details about it, other than to say Extra Life is an amazing charity that helps kids who need medical care get the treatment they need when their families cannot afford that treatment. So Extra Life is very important, and we're going to be benefiting Boston Children's Hospital. So you can make a donation to that if you wish. We'll have a link later on. Our website is getting up and running. Let'sRollCon.com will be where that is. There's a Facebook page as well for Let's Roll Convention and an event on Facebook for it. So if you are interested in any of that, please reach out. You can reach out to me personally at Jonathan@WargamingRecon.com and I'll pass it on. Or if you just go to Let's Roll Convention on Facebook, you can leave a message there as well. So like I said, that'll be May 16th, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it should be a lot of fun. We have board games, card games, role-playing games, miniatures games as well, all virtually. We're going to have panels, and we're going to have seminars, and there'll be interviews with top guests. There's going to be a digital marketplace where you can purchase stuff from a variety of vendors. There'll be discounts and all this kind of stuff. You do need to register, but it is 100% free. So we're looking forward to that. And then let's move on to the Lumber Mill segment of the show. This is, of course, sponsored by Things from the Basement. And today I want to talk about some of their buildings from their Russian Village series. This was their very first Kickstarter. I want to talk about the livestock buildings. Not all, but most of them, actually, I want to talk about. And this retails for $19.50. You get quite a lot in this set. You get a chicken coop, you get a pig pen, you get a horse trough, and you get a selection of split rail looking fences. You have 5 long fence panels, 4 shorter fence panels. There's a gate in there as well, and it is just really cool. So this is, of course, as their naming goes, it is intended for the Russian Village, which would be great for really just about any time period at any place. They intended, I believe, for bolt action. So you're looking at Eastern Front, when Germany invaded Russia, and you're looking at all that kind of stuff. But you could honestly use these things for the Wild West. You could use it just about any country, just about any time period, and you would be well served by it. I want to talk about the chicken coop first. The chicken coop is absolutely beautiful. It's easy to assemble. It makes sense. It has great detail on it. The only thing about it that was a little confusing for me, or actually maybe a little more of something that I would suggest as an improvement, is the roof. So the way that the roof lines up, And judging by the instructions, it's hard to tell whether the roof panels come to a peak with this little valley in the middle, or if one roof is supposed to be slightly longer and go over the other. And so what I did with mine, figuring it's a Russian village and that it's going to be put up by peasants maybe who don't have a lot of time and they're exhausted from being in the fields all day and everything, I figured that this would be a little haphazard. So my roof is a little askew, doesn't line up just right, but I figured that's okay with the character of things. And I mean, this is just a minor thing. It's easy enough for you to just do it however you want. There's no wrong way to do it. I just wish, based off the way that they've handled roofs before in other kits, that there was a little clearer definition on how they suggest you do it and ways to line it up. But this is a gorgeous piece. I absolutely love it. I wish you could buy this separately, but this is just, it's fantastic. I love this chicken coop, and I want dozens of them. You also get, they call it a paddock, but really, it's a pig pen. And the pig pen is amazing. It has a nice, thick MDF base. Then you build the pig pen itself in it, which is really cool. The roof goes on it, and then you have these nice, kind of ramshackle-looking fencing that goes around it, and a gate in the back. Standard building technique for things for the basement fences and everything. One neat thing that they've done in order to add extra definition to it to show that the posts for the fence are thicker is you build the fence up, and then afterwards there's these pieces that go separately behind it that line up with the posts, and those pieces then make it look like each post is thicker, like a single post. And at first I was like, why do I have all these extra pieces? And it didn't make sense. And then I looked at the thing and I was like, aha! So it was really, really cool for that. This is another piece. As general, I recommend all things in the basement kits that you should paint them before you assemble them, or at least base coat them. I do spray cans for that kind of stuff. You could use just about anything, and I would recommend that as well. There is one word of advice, I guess, that I want to give you, though. So usually what I do with kits like this that have a base, before I actually glue a lot of the stuff onto it, I will take care of the base. So I will paint it or whatever, and I like to use the Citadel Sterling Battlemire or Sterling Mud on the base. And I did that on this, and I tried my best to not cover any of the holes to the fencing. I did pretty well, but the problem is some of the fence pieces are actually meant to be flush with the base. So I found myself scraping away paint and texture that I had put on. So I would honestly advise you to not paint this base or texture it or anything until after you glue the fencing on. So glue the fencing on first, glue all the other pieces on. You can actually texture the part where the pig pen is if you want the inside to be textured. But I would wait on the fencing and everything and do the fencing and then glue the stuff in. And the last piece about this I want to talk, because the rest are actual just big fence pieces. The last piece I want to talk about is a horse trough. And this is the most disappointing piece for me in the whole set. And part of it is my own ineptitude, and no doubt that a more skilled modeler could do this better. I had a lot of trouble with this, kind of like I did with the outhouse, in part because it all just kind of locks together. So you need to glue like many things together all at the same time. And the instructions tell you like to glue the bottom and then the two small end pieces first, and then you can do the sides and everything. But unless you, like, the end pieces won't set at the right angles if you don't have the side pieces in to kind of keep them right. So I did this like 8 or 10 times. I tried and I came so close to giving up until finally I got it and it went. But even then, even if it goes together, as mine did, you get some gaps in the bottom, and that's just the way of the kit, because in order to get it all the way to go with a slant, it's not possible because of the thickness of the MDF. And so this is just, it's not great. It's okay. It's a thing I'd love to see reinvented by Jorg and worked on some more. And I mean, he's done the best that you could do with this, I think, right now, without doing a lot of significant work on it. And it's such a small piece. But just seeing the gaps in it are a little disappointing. You could add putty in and fill the gaps that way, or spackle or whatever. And you could do stuff that would take care of it. I have not. But that is our Lumber Mill segment, and we hope that you will enjoy the rest of the show.
Well, everyone, thank you so much. And you know the drill. No matter how busy you are, no matter how much time you're spending thinking, which thing that Henry does should I invest time in first? You know that you have to. You gotta. You need to. That's right. Keep on gaming. Are you always on the go? Why not take Wargaming Recon with you? If you use an app like Pocket Casts, you can listen to your favorite episodes of Wargaming Recon on your mobile device. Wargaming Recon is a proud member of the TSR Podcast Network. Visit wargamingrecon.com/TSRPN for more information and to learn about the other good shows on the network. This recording is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. Many thanks to Andrew and Court for inspiring the show's name. Wargaming Recon is dedicated to the memory of longtime listener Andrew. I ask all listeners to join me in a moment of silence in memory of Andrew. Thank you to everyone who backed our 2020 podcast season on Kickstarter. In particular, I would like to thank Bob Yates, Cigar Box Battle, Enfilade Convention, Jason Elliott, leader of TSR Games, John Vogel, Lead Bears Tufts, Nate Taylor of Dwarven Forge, Ryzen Phoenix GameCon, and Stefan Pagoni, founder of Dwarven Forge. We couldn't have been successful without the help of all of you. Thank you so very much, and hope you are enjoying this 2020 podcast season. Wargaming Recon is made possible by listeners like you. Become a Patreon backer to get behind-the-scenes content and new episodes before everyone else, starting at $1 per month. Visit wargamingrecon.com/Patreon to become a Patreon backer. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by The Wargaming Company. Wish you could play a great Napoleonics wargame that's different from the same old stuff? Try ESR. ESR makes Napoleonics accessible, a complete system with you as a core commander. Start an army with ESR box sets or use your existing collection. It's meaty enough for diehards, but friendly for newcomers. Visit thewargamingcompany.com. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by Enfilade. Enfilade is a flagship historical wargaming convention for the Northwest Historical Miniature Gaming Society. Enfilade is held annually over Memorial Day weekend at the Red Lion Inn in Olympia, Washington. Enjoy the largest historical miniature gaming convention west of the Mississippi at Enfilade. Visit www.nhmgscitadel.com for more information. Wargaming Recon is proudly sponsored by the Maine Historical Wargamers Association. They're the folks behind Huzzah! Historical Wargaming for New England. Huzzah takes place May 15th to the 17th, 2020 at the Doubletree in South Portland, Maine. Experience some of the best historical wargaming at Huzzah! Visit www.huzzahcon.com for more information.